Topic 45. The Requirements Pit. Perfection is achieved not when there is nothing left to add, but when there is nothing left to take away. That's Antoine de Saint-Exupéry in Wind, Sand, and Stars. Many books and tutorials refer to requirements gathering as an early phase of the project. The word gathering seems to imply a tribe of happy analysts foraging for nuggets of wisdom that are lying on the ground all around them while the pastoral symphony plays gently in the background. Gathering implies that the requirements are already there. You need merely find them, place them in your basket, and be merrily on your way. It doesn't quite work that way. Requirements rarely lie on the surface. Normally, they're buried deep beneath layers of assumptions, misconceptions, and politics. Even worse, often they don't really exist at all. Tip 75. No one knows exactly what they want. The requirements myth. In the early days of software, computers were more valuable, in terms of amortized cost per hour, than the people who worked with them. We saved money by trying to get things correct the first time. Part of that process was trying to specify exactly what we were going to get the machine to do. We'd start by getting a specification of the requirements, parlay that into a design document, then into flowcharts and pseudocode, and finally into code. Before feeding it into a computer, though, we'd spend time desk-checking it. It cost a lot of money, and that cost meant that people only tried to automate something when they knew exactly what they wanted. As early machines were fairly limited, the scope of problems they solved was constrained. It was actually possible to understand the whole problem before you started. But that is not the real world. The real world is messy, conflicted, and unknown. In that world, exact specifications of anything are rare, if not downright impossible. That's where we programmers come in. Our job is to help people understand what they want. In fact, that's probably our most valuable attribute. And it's worth repeating. Tip 76. Programmers help people understand what they want. Programming as therapy. Let's call the people who ask us to write software our clients. The typical client comes to us with a need. The need may be strategic, but is just as likely to be a tactical issue, a response to a current problem. The need may be for a change to an existing system, or it may ask for something new. The need will sometimes be expressed in business terms and sometimes in technical ones. The mistake new developers often make is to take this statement of need and implement a solution for it. In our experience, this initial statement of need is not an absolute requirement. The client may not realize this, but it is really an invitation to explore. Let's take a simple example. You work for a publisher of paper and electronic books. You're given a new requirement. Shipping should be free on all orders costing $50 or more. Stop for a second, and imagine yourself in that position. What's the first thing that comes to mind? The chances are very good that you had questions. Does the $50 include tax? Does the $50 include current shipping charges? Does the $50 have to be for paper books, or can the order also include ebooks? What kind of shipping is offered? Priority? Ground? What about international orders? How often will the $50 limit change in the future? That's what we do. When given something that seems simple, we annoy people by looking for edge cases and asking about them. The chances are the client will have already thought of some of these and just assumed that the implementation would work that way. Asking the question just flushes that information out. But other questions will likely be things that the client hadn't previously considered. That's where things get interesting, and where a good developer learns to be diplomatic. You might start a conversation like this.
We were wondering about the $50 total. Does that include what we'd normally charge for shipping?
Of course, it's the total that they'd pay us.
That's nice and simple for our customers to understand. I can see the attraction, but I can see some less scrupulous customers trying to game that system.
How so?
Well, let's say they buy a book for $25 and then select overnight shipping, the most expensive option, that'd be likely about $30, making the whole order $55. We'd then make the shipping free and they'd get overnight shipping on a book for $25.
At this point, the experienced developer stops, deliver facts, and let the client make the decisions.
Ouch. That certainly wasn't what I intended. We'd lose money on those orders. What are the options?
And this starts an exploration. Your role in this is to interpret what the client says and to feed back to them the implications. This is both an intellectual process and a creative one. You're thinking on your feet and you're contributing to a solution that is likely to be better than one that either you or the client would have produced alone. Requirements are a process. In the previous example, the developer took the requirements and fed back a consequence to the client. This initiated the exploration. During that exploration, you are likely to come up with more feedback as the client plays with different solutions. This is the reality of all requirements gathering. Tip 77. Requirements are learned in a feedback loop. Your job is to help the client understand the consequences of their stated requirements. You do that by generating feedback and letting them use that feedback to refine their thinking. In the previous example, the feedback was easy to express in words. Sometimes that's not the case, and sometimes you honestly won't know enough about the domain to be as specific as that. In those cases, pragmatic programmers rely on the "Is this what you meant?" school of feedback. We produce mock-ups and prototypes and let the client play with them. Ideally, the things we produce are flexible enough that we can change them during our discussions with the client, letting us respond to, "That isn't what I meant," with, "So, more like this?" Sometimes these mock-ups can be thrown together in an hour or so. They are obviously just hacks to get an idea across. But the reality is that all of the work we do is actually some form of mock-up. Even at the end of a project, we're still interpreting what our client wants. In fact, by that point, we're likely to have more clients. The QA people, operations, marketing, and maybe even test groups of customers. So the pragmatic programmer looks at all of the project as a requirements gathering exercise. That's why we prefer short iterations, ones that end with direct client feedback. This keeps us on track and makes sure that if we do go in the wrong direction, the amount of time lost is minimized. Walk in your client's shoes. There's a simple technique for getting inside your client's heads that isn't used often enough. Become a client. Are you writing a system for the help desk? Spend a couple of days monitoring the phones with an experienced support person. Are you automating a manual stock control system? Work in the warehouse for a week. Does a week sound like a long time? It really isn't, particularly when you're looking at processes in which management and workers occupy different worlds. Management will give you one view of how things operate, but when you get down on the floor, you'll find a very different reality, one that will take time to assimilate. As well as giving you insight into how the system will really be used, you'd be amazed at how the request, "May I sit in for a week while you do your job?" helps build trust and establishes a basis for communication with your clients. Just remember not to get in the way. Tip 78. Work with a user to think like a user. Gathering feedback is also the time to start building a rapport with your client base, learning their expectations and hopes for the system you are building. Requirements versus policy. Let's imagine that while discussing a human resources system, a client says, "Only an employee's supervisors and the personnel department may view that employee's records." Is this statement truly a requirement? Perhaps today, but it embeds business policy in an absolute statement. Business policy? Requirement. It's a relatively subtle distinction, but it's one that will have profound implications for the developers. If the requirement is stated as, "Only supervisors and personnel can view an employee record," the developer may end up coding an explicit test every time the application accesses this data. However, if the statement is, only authorized users may access an employee record, the developer will probably design and implement some kind of access control system. When policy changes, and it will, only the metadata for that system will need to be updated. In fact, gathering requirements in this way naturally leads you to a system that is well factored to support metadata. There's a general rule here. Tip 79. Policy is metadata. Implement the general case, with the policy information as an example of the type of thing the system needs to support. Requirements versus reality. In a January 1999 Wired magazine article, producer and musician Brian Eno described an incredible piece of technology, the ultimate mixing board. It does anything to sound that can be done. And yet, instead of letting musicians make better music or produce a recording faster or less expensively, it gets in the way. It disrupts the creative process. To see why, you have to look at how recording engineers work. They balance sounds intuitively. Over the years, they develop an innate feedback loop between their ears and their fingertips, sliding faders, rotating knobs, and so on. However, the interface to the new mixer didn't leverage off those abilities. Instead, it forced its users to type on a keyboard or click a mouse. The functions it provided were comprehensive, but they were packaged in unfamiliar and exotic ways. The functions the engineers needed were sometimes hidden behind obscure names or were achieved with non-intuitive combinations of basic facilities. This example also illustrates our belief that successful tools adapt to the hands that use them. Successful requirements gathering takes this into account. And this is why early feedback, with prototypes or tracer bullets, will let your clients say, "Yes, it does what I want, but not how I want." Documenting requirements. We believe that the best requirements documentation, perhaps the only requirements documentation, is working code. But that doesn't mean that you can get away without documenting your understanding of what the client wants. It just means that those documents are not a deliverable. They are not something that you give to a client to sign off on. Instead, they are simply mileposts to help guide the implementation process. In the past, both Andy and Dave have been on projects that produced incredibly detailed requirements. These substantial documents expanded on the client's initial 2-minute explanation of what was wanted, producing inch-thick masterpieces full of diagrams and tables. Things were specified to the point where there was almost no room for ambiguity in the implementation. Given sufficiently powerful tools, the document could actually be the final program. Creating these documents was a mistake for 2 reasons. First, as we've discussed, the client doesn't actually know what they want up front. So, when we take what they say and expand it into what is almost a legal document, we are building an incredibly complex castle on quicksand. You might say, "But then we take the document to the client and they sign off on it. We're getting feedback." And that leads us to the second problem with these requirement specifications. The client never reads them. The client uses programmers because, while the client is motivated by solving a high-level and somewhat nebulous problem, programmers are interested in all the details and nuances. The requirements document is written for developers and contains information and subtleties that are sometimes incomprehensible and frequently boring to the client. Submit a 200-page requirements document, and the client will likely heft it to decide if it weighs enough to be important. They may read the first couple of paragraphs, which is why the first 2 paragraphs are always titled Management Summary, and they may flick through the rest, sometimes stopping when there's a neat diagram. This isn't putting the client down, but giving them a large technical document is like giving the average developer a copy of the Iliad in Homeric Greek and asking them to code the video game from it. Requirements documents are for planning. So we don't believe in the monolithic, heavy enough to stun an ox requirements document. We do, however, know that requirements have to be written down simply because developers on a team need to know what they'll be doing. What form does this take? We favor something that can fit on a real, or a virtual, index card. These short descriptions are often called user stories. They describe what a small portion of the application should do from the perspective of a user of that functionality. When written this way, the requirements can be placed on a board and moved around to show both status and priority. You might think that a single index card can't hold the information needed to implement a component of the application. You'd be right. And that's part of the point. By keeping this statement of requirements short, you're encouraging developers to ask clarifying questions. You're enhancing the feedback process between clients and coders before and during the creation of each piece of code. Over-specification. Another big danger in producing a requirements document is being too specific. Good requirements are abstract. Where requirements are concerned, the simplest statement that accurately reflects the business need is best. This doesn't mean you can be vague. You must capture the underlying semantic invariance as requirements and document the specific or current work practices as policy. Requirements are not architecture. Requirements are not design, nor are they the user interface. Requirements are need. Just one more wafer-thin mint. Many project failures are blamed on an increase in scope, also known as feature bloat, creeping featureism, or requirements creep. This is an aspect of the boiled frog syndrome. What can we do to prevent requirements from creeping up on us? The answer, again, is feedback. If you're working with the client in iterations with constant feedback, then the client will experience firsthand the impact of just one more feature. They'll see another story card go up on the board, and they'll get to help choose another card to move into the next iteration to make room. Feedback works both ways. Maintain a glossary. As soon as you start discussing requirements, users and domain experts will use certain terms that have specific meaning to them. They may differentiate between a client and a customer, for example. It would then be inappropriate to use either word casually in the system. Tip 80. Use a project glossary. Create and maintain a project glossary, one place that defines all the specific terms and vocabulary used in a project. All participants in the project, from end users to support staff, should use the glossary to ensure consistency. This implies that the glossary needs to be widely accessible, a good argument for online documentation. It's hard to succeed on a project if users and developers call the same thing by different names or, even worse, refer to different things by the same name. Here's a couple of challenges. Can you use the software you are writing? Is it possible to have a good feel for requirements without being able to use the software yourself? Pick a non-computer-related problem you currently need to solve. Generate requirements for a non-computer solution.